comes in weeks, and I was beginning to be comforted, and it's the charge against God, and God explains to him, and he's all happy about it. And he's just saying, of course, the story of Abraham, Sodom and Gomorrah, and the brother of Jared, concessions, or to the fire height, that the church and our word awareness, aware, to be aware of a thing. And Varnheim is that of which you are aware, that which you are aware. That is, not surface impressions, but casual, unconsidered, simple contact. Again, you see, very often what is behind the... You can refuse to surrender to more occurrences or to a local, emergency. There's Veritas, there's Varheit, you know there's something more there, and you stick to it. And again, our word truth, then we use cowering. Plow is that which you can trust, it's real to your trust. You can trust in that, on which you can build. It's a total assurance and confidence. Cowering is what is true. We are cowering, that means I accept that, I trust that, I will ask for that, I will accept that. That's part of the truth, that's the aspect, the intention. So truth then, the spirit of truth identifies that particular spirit. The only one is the relationship which does not receive the only one which does not have a very
where? Well, that's short. Only two verses, two very important verses. The question is, as we've seen all along, what should we be doing in these last days? It all depends. Here, three of the brethren ask for specific instructions. They're told, there's no information more valuable than that than what we can be doing, because there can be doing anything, you know. But when you once make the choice, you give up all your other options. What should we be doing? You may be doing the wrong thing. You could have been doing something better. Well, I told you three things here in a very let your time be devoted. Three things. Farming, your living, church work, and studying the scriptures. Well, what more do you want? Compare this with what was told to Emma in the second verse of the preceding chapter, where she's told, be faithful, walk in paths of virtue, you'll be preserved in your life, and receive her inheritance of desire. Now that is the objective of the second verse of the preceding chapter section gives us the objective, and this is how the brethren are to achieve it. And you notice, as we mentioned before, that is the maximum one can hope for in this life. The best thing that could possibly happen is given there. Well, how do you achieve it? Again, how very simple. A very simple routine is given. You don't expect to hope for more. You do your farming, you do your church work, and you read the scriptures. He tells us here, let your time be devoted to, in verse order here, not in verse order, that's going to be most important. Let your time be devoted to studying of the scriptures and preaching and confirming the church, doing your church work, you'll notice, performing your labors in the on the land, as you're farming, that's what you're doing. Well, then that's basic. Adam does the same. Adam, remember, he cultivates the earth, he's been told to be. He calls upon the Lord, he erects an altar and calls upon the Lord, and in reply to that, we're told in many versions, the three instructed come and teach him and give him the scripture. An angel comes with a book in some versions, Moroni in others, three men come with a book and so forth. But those three things can take up our life. Of course, farming isn't the main activity we engage in today. So that's where our substance comes from in the end, and we'll be as far as we need to go. About what percent of the people of Utah now are engaged in farming? Less than 8% in the last. It used to be, of course, to the farming state. It's 80%. Now it's 8%. That's what's happening there. Ed may be sensible to go back to it, too. Of course, they want to do it on a modern scale, with our gardens and so forth. But in the end, our sustenance from the earth, our work in the church together, and the scriptures. And this is important here. Until you go west, notice they're receiving specific instructions on what to do because they need that. They could have done other things too. And when you go west, then it shall be made what you shall do then. When you come to that, then you'll know. But at the particular moment, there's a certain thing you must be doing. That may not be the thing you're required to do 10 years from now or 2 years from now. You may be somewhere else. Found on a mission, but it's a different type of work. Thank you very much. And here again, comes an interesting question. And it's something, here the brethren are receiving direct instruction from the Lord in all things they're supposed to do. And they are the living promise. But still, they need the scriptures. They need those ancient written records. It's very important. With the instruction, you need the book. It always is. The scriptures were there, but the Lord was there to explain. Nevertheless, the Lord being there in person, he still brought the books with him. Now the next verse is very interesting. Another 3 points. All things must be done by faith. Without faith and without good faith, we're not going to get anything done at all. First Corinthians 8. The second is by prayer, which is the first, the most impulsive reaction to faith. If you really believe, the first thing you will do is want to call upon the Lord. Natural thing in the mind. Because the minute you have faith in him, you know he's there, and you know your own limitations are very obvious. So what you do, you call upon the Lord. And thirdly, you're not alone. It must all be done by common consent in the church. So, this verse is important. And all things shall be done by common consent in the church. By much prayer and faith, for all things you shall receive by faith. Notice that is the first verse. All things will come by faith. Notice in both these verses, you go in verse order. You get more importance as it comes. No, the first goes in the order of ABC, the second in the order of CBA. It goes backwards. All things shall be done by common consent, by much prayer and faith, for all things you shall be received by faith. This short 26 seconds. It takes care of everything. Well, I don't know whether we should go into St. Augustine and all that sort of thing. That's Well, now after this, it leads us to the second. The 27th section is a direct revelation. It comes direct from the Lord. And it is a real thriller here. This one is, all ours, matter of fact. But listen to the voice of Jesus Christ, your Lord, your God, your Redeemer, whose word is quick and powerful. Now, the story here was that Joseph went to get the sacramental bread and wine, and he was met on the way by a messenger. Well, the messenger, an angel, of course. Messenger in Greek is angel, it's simply the Greek word for messenger. He was met by him and told him, was given this. Now, I've got the second request from Salt Lake this week. The question has come up, should we use either wine or water? And of course, an infection in the end times that has to do with people that have questions. Does it make any difference whether we use wine or water? What did they do in the early church? Is there any particular reason why water should take the place of wine? Well, actually, in the early church, in the earliest records we have of sacraments, they used water instead of wine. So they were very much aware of the fact that it could have been wine just as well. This interchange is interesting. Notice he starts out by saying, it mattereth not what ye shall eat or drink in the sacrament. You can use potatoes and buttermilk as well as anything else. No, it was in the prescribed scope. The scripture makes it very clear that it is bread and wine.
But what kind of bread and what kind of wine? This is the point. The same thing, the question arises with baptism. See, obviously we have to keep it within that scope. There's never been any doubt that that's the sacrament consists of bread and wine. It doesn't mean that I say this is saying, well, you can have anything you want in that. We can have a beefsteak and beer as far as that goes. No, that's not what it means at all. What kind of bread and wine? And they were worried about that, or should they have what? But then in the case of baptism, it doesn't matter what kind, what you're baptized in, doesn't it? It means that the Christian world teaches that if you don't have water, you can baptize with something else, with milk as far as that goes. That's what we were taught in the army. And if a person was in extreme not to die, you could administer to them. Anybody could. You didn't have to be a priest or anybody else. And this is what most Catholics do. They wouldn't be eternally damned. Anyone could be baptized. And if you didn't have water to baptize with, you were instructed to use anything else you had. You could use sand, or you could use dirt if you didn't have sand. Now, that's carrying it a bit far. Can't you baptize with a little sprinkling of dirt? Well, that isn't what it meant. To baptize is to immerse in water. So I was baptized in a pot bubbling sulfur water in Sulphur Spring, Jackson Springs, Oregon. That's not the best. I mean, it was water, you see, as far as I know. And there are some churches that think you could baptize some sex only in water from the River Jordan. Jordan water. Jordan water to sprinkle on people. And we once had a woman who sang with us, and they would only sprinkle with seawater. They would never baptize with anything but seawater. And others, well, with respect to the ice act and so forth, had to be Nile water. That you would have to do. Well, there you go, it was all water. I mean, we baptize in the sea. The church is baptized in the sea, and the Adriatic there to baptize on the beach. In brackish water and salt water. I would recommend the Great Salt Lake as a dead sea. The point is it's water. You can't just use anything. It's the same thing. And notice he makes that clear in the next thing when he says in the same verse, as long as so be that you do it with an eye single to my glory. Well, of course, if your eye is single, then you won't quibble. And with an eye single to his glory, you know what it means, and you won't go into all these quibbles and hair splittings as to what substance you could use and how much you could use. That's exactly the sort of thing we talk about in the Talmud. The Talmud is purposely explaining Moses' law right down to the fine point. How far is far, how much is much, how long is long, and so forth. And the doctors endlessly argue about that. He says, don't argue with people about that. If your eye is single to my glory, then that won't be the issue. That isn't the issue. If your eye is single to my glory, that's the difference. Then it won't make any difference. And you know what it is. But he says, that is making it clear that it is wine and bread that he's referring to. So that you do it with an eye single, remembering unto the Father, my body which was laid down for you, and my blood which was shed for the remission of your sins. Wherefore I give unto him to show, not purchase wine, neither strong drink, of your enemies. Now, and also, of course, remembering unto the Father, that is the sacrament. Moroni 4:3. We do witness unto thee, O God, the eternal Father, that we do always remember him. We witness to the Father that we remember the Son. This is what it is done for here. And it's not merely a pious gesture. It is a covenant witnessed by the Father and made with the Son in recognition of what the Son has done for us. And the wine in the next verse, we learn, is symbolic. It may not be commercial for that reason. So it doesn't want us to use commercial products here. They may be, that's an interesting thing. The whole creation of their dances, which you know is quite elaborate, will never use anything store bought. They're not supposed to. The coloring is all natural dye. When they start buying things from the stores, when they started buying paint from the shop in Albuquerque, places like that, to paint their kachinas, I know some of the old timers were really shocked by that, because you mustn't use any. The coloring must all be from berries, from minerals that you find yourself.
and the aprons and all must be that both you have woven yourself, and the skins from the deer you hunted yourself, and so forth. It all must be of pure native material. What was the reason for that? Well, if it's been put back, it's the same stuff, it's the same material, and so forth. Yes, but they say, what do you know about processing? What do we know about processing today? Almost all processing today entails a measure of corruption of some sort, physical pollution. Any time a car jumps the track today, they have to evacuate a town because these chemicals that are being transported all over the country to be used in industrial processes that apparently, no matter what the process is, are deadly poison in various states. We live in a strange world of corruption. Nothing seems to be native and pure or safe anymore until you finally come up with the end product, and it turns out that that causes cancer. Almost every case, we can't win here. Notice he wants to keep things as pure and simple as possible. You shall not purchase wine or strong drink of your enemies. The kind you should do is make it yourself, and make it new of London, so you can be sure of its quality and its purity. Therefore you shall partake of none except it be made new. This is my father's kingdom, which should be built up. So they decided to have water instead. Today there are people suspicious of water. So what are we going to do about that? Like the water of baptism, something it has to be running water. All these particulars. But this is now interesting. This wine is a symbol, but it's more than a mere symbol. It tells us here it's a mystery. It says, don't marvel at it. It's wisdom in me. I'm actually going to drink wine with you later on. And it must be new wine. It must be tiros. Now the Hebrews, the sacrificial wine, at the Passover and at the sacrament, from the supplement of the IQS, the first scroll, the Dead Sea Scrolls, any time 10 are met together in the church, they must have a sacrament. It must be administered by a priest. It must be bread, but it must be the bread of the last first fruits. Brought to sacrificial field, the last fruit of the grain, the first one. And the wine must be tiros. It must be new wine. New unfermented wine. And this is an interesting thing. It says a great deal about it being that particular thing. And that has something to do with the symbolism. It's the new wine because it's the wine of the new covenant. And the Lord uses that expression. He uses it in Matthew 9, 17, Mark 2, 22, 26, and so forth. But when he talks about the new covenant as new wine poured into old bottles, it's not as old bottles. You do not put new wine in old bottles. And you don't put old wine in new bottles. And again, when he says, this looks forward to the time when I will partake of the fruit of the vine new with you, anew. I'll partake it anew in the new kingdom of my Father, in my Father's kingdom. Where he tells us it says that they made there in Acts 2:13 in the early church, it was new wine in Matthew 26 and Mark 14, Luke 22 and so forth, that the Lord will drink of the wine when it's new with them on the earth. And he tells us that here in the fifth verse. This is wisdom in me, wherefore, notice he's talking about it. It's wisdom in me, and don't marvel. There's something wonderful about this. But he says, I remember, it's more than just mere symbolism. The hour cometh that I will drink the fruit of the vine with you on the earth. And then he goes down through all the dispensations, beginning with the last one to come, Moroni, works right back to Adam, and representatives of each dispensation are going to be there and drink of the new wine with him. He goes through seven or eight dispensations here, working backwards. It's very interesting. See, there's the gospel of the seven wise men. We have a big picture of them in 152 up there. Smith's only. I wonder what happened to it. It was a business painting. There's the romantic speech that are all done. Showing the doctor of the ancient, which is very old. It goes back to prehistoric times.
the three wise men, not the three wise men, the seven wise men. The seven wise men representing the different regions of the earth and the different dispensations. And they all come together periodically. Every dispensation, they come together and hold a feast together. Each one representing his own people, his own dispensation. They come together and exchange wisdom and ideas from each other and find out what they've heard. But once every 1,000 years, they come together for this feast, the feast of the wise, the septum sapientum of the Middle Ages they talk about. But this came from the Orient. It's very old, the doctrine that there are seven wise, because they were supposed to be, just as there are the seven wandering bodies in the sky, the seven planets, seven wanderings as against the fixed stars. They represent the wandering ones that are the visitors, planet means seven. And they wander around, and in the same way we have the 70 who are the missionaries that go forth into the world and always keep wandering at the seven. They're supposed to be the 72 jarring, 72 tongues, 70 languages of the earth and so forth. And in Israel, as in the early church, there were the 70. They took it over because they had 7 wives. There were Solomon, Moses, and Thales was one of them. These 7 wise men was the slowest, but they went back to the time of Lehi. They were all contemporaries of Lehi. Lehi would have been one of the 7 wise men. But the idea was was very ancient before that. The seven books of learning and so on, representing the 7 major branches of wisdom, are represented in the earliest Egyptian inscriptions we have. Society of the seven coming together. Well, here we have the Feast of the Wise Men, and the Lord says that he is going to partake of the divine new here on the earth. I says, this isn't something that will be mystical up above or just a symbolic sort of thing. He says, are you going to do it? It begins with Moroni, and immediately that brings us around. We say, Moroni, there's a real person. This was the man who came and brought those plates and handed them to Joseph. This was the man who came and visited him again and again and again and talked with him long hours. The man who buried the plates, who came as a resurrected being, here is a real person. And Moroni is the first one mentioned because he is the last one. The preceding dispensations, he is the last one to hand over the record and the gospel. His time, the 5th century after Christ, was the last time. So we get the dispensation of Moroni. But notice he says here about this newness, why it should be new wine. And behold, his wisdom in me, the hour cometh. And this is according to the New Testament, where he says it must be new wine, a new covenant, in the new kingdom to come, which shall be built up on the earth. He says here, notice in the 4th verse, this is my Father's kingdom. Notice, wherefore you shall be partaker of none except it be made new among you in my Father's kingdom, which shall be built up on the earth. It's the new kingdom. So we go back to Moroni.
What was the New Testament reference?
The New Testament reference for the kingdom. Well, this is Acts 2:13, saying in the early church said, but then Matthew 26:29, Mark 14:25, I haven't heard it. I would have brought the New Testament along, but we've got to move, or we'll never get to the more exciting part of the doctrine. Moving on here. And then with Moroni, and then comes next, the mysterious Elias. Notice, this is bringing things together. It culminates in the 13th verse, where he says they're all going to be brought together in one. And it's Moroni who brought the books together. And he tells us, notice what he tells us, why Moroni is in the picture, because he brings the books together. He revealed the Book of Mormon, containing the fullness of my everlasting gospel, who I have committed the keys of the record, of the stick of Ephraim. He has the keys to the record. He brings the books together, does Moroni. And then Elias, who brings the keys together. And then John the Baptist, who brings the living and the dead together, as we learn in Luke. That was his business, his baptism, and his baptism for the dead. And then 8, John, the John who brought the priesthood together.
and with John, my servant Joseph Smith, Oliver Cowdery, to ordain you to the first priesthood which you have received, that you might be called. He was the last one to hold the Aaronic priesthood and carry it on. He brings the priesthood. All these things are being brought back, restored, and brought together. And then, after him, we come to Elijah, who brings all the generations together. Of course, this is the work of the temple. Again, my servant Elijah, and so forth, was Elijah who came to the Kirtland temple to bring these things together. So, in the ninth verse, I'm also Elijah, to whom I've committed the key to the power of turning the hearts of the fathers to the children of the heartless. He brings all the generations together, past, present, living, and dead. A marvelous work. And then come the patriarchs. Those who are going back, they come before Elijah. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Again, the patriarchs are given in reverse order. You notice they're going backwards in time in the 10th verse. Joseph was the youngest. Then Jacob, then Isaac, then Abraham. Instead of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he's going reverse. The time is being right backwards. Right from the beginning here, from the moment it was delivered to Joseph Smith, we're going back in time, and finally we get to Adam, as you might expect. But the patriarchs, what do they bring? They bring the covenants together. And then finally, from them, you go back to Michael, or Adam, the father of all, the prince of all, the ancient of days. So we've gone right back to the beginning. And he brings all things of earth together. Notice he's the father of all and the prince of all. But then comes a break. After Adam, the 12th verse, comes Peter, James, and John. Well, that breaks our own origin. Who brought the gospel to Adam? Peter, James, and John. Was that to bring the gospel to Adam? They were the ones that taught him when he prayed and was in the dark and didn't know anything, had been promised greater life and truth. Then three were sent to teach him, and it was Peter, James, and John. So we're still going back in time. They brought it back to him. The interesting thing, since this was given in August 1830, and the temple ordinances weren't established until 1840, 1838, 1840, they made them up. You got them from the Masons later on. You find it all the way through the Book of Mormon, you find it all constantly referring to that order. So it goes back to Peter, James, and John. Because they bring heaven and earth together. They brought the gospel from heaven to Adam in the first place. Notice, by whom I have ordained you and conferred you apostles. So now this is a complete circle. It was Peter, James, and John that came in the beginning and ordained Adam. They who come in the end and ordained Joseph alone. So I say this completes the circle. And what's the purpose? Next verse, to bring all things together in one. How neatly is that? Notice how cunningly this thing is constructed. You think Joseph Smith must have worked months to figure this all out and get it all set down and discuss it with the No, none of that. It was just tossed off as he was going along the road. He was met by a messenger. It says the first part was written. Then as soon as he got home, he wrote it, put out what the messenger told him. And the following month, this was August, a couple of weeks later, they finished the rest. What the whole concept behind this, why they were so concerned about bringing about this water and this wine, is another view of the sacrament, that eternal covenant. It's the sacrament, when they come together, all these patriarchs are going to come together and they're going to have a sacrament. You're going to have a sacrament.
Lay yourself wide open if you do.
And so here we are. And so this 13th verse, I say, unto whom I have committed the keys of my kingdom and a dispensation of the gospel for the last time, brings it all together. For the fullness of time, for which I will gather together in one all things, both in heaven and which are on earth. Now there is a program. To gather all things together, both in heaven and on earth. This is for a grand finale, the entire company assembled on the stage here. But they have the keys, and the keys have been returned. It's a dispensation of the gospel, it's the last time, it's the fullness of time. And it doesn't stop there. In the next verse, and also, if more staggering, with all those whom my Father hath given me out of the world, by that. Remember, he quotes praise repeatedly in 35 and in
John, the Lord's Prayer to the Father. And those who have come out of the world, they must be in it also. Well, I would make a suggestion here. Who would they be? Well, ask yourself, how many spirits have come to earth that have never really lived in the world, that have never partaken of the trials and tests and the probation, which is the purpose of this life, have left almost before they were born? We just had a quick passing. They were never put to the test, the rest of us have. There are many of them. Persons, not only that died in infancy, which is represented by far the vast majority of the human race, but also those who have been denied in so many other ways. I mean, who received injuries, or mentally retarded, or all sorts of things. They are those who are out of the world, have never been in the world, but they belong to. They must be brought into it also. There's also which the Father had given them. They needed no rigorous probation. So we can ask ourselves, how many souls have never had substance in participation in the activities and the temptations and the sins and the triumphs of the world? Most of the spirits never went through it all. They were those who were out of the world. You could include them among them. Well, now in this 15th verse, we have an enormous trust. The world is about to pass from one phase of existence to another. It's about to pass away and be seated by another world. Now, who is up to bearing such a burden? How is this to be done? Talk about small beginnings. Here's nothing but Joseph. I mean, absolutely poor, but penniless. That's nothing. Out in the country, being forced to move around, farming when they could, but not getting much of a chance at that. How are they going to start revolutionizing the whole history of the solar system? Because a new world is going to come into existence, and they're going to inaugurate it. Such that is a very large order. Well, this is what we're supposed to do. Now we start giving instructions in this 15th verse. First of all, don't feel discouraged. It's all good news. Lift up your hearts and rejoice. It's a happy event. It's a good thing that has happened. Not the other. The other's passing away, but it's all for the good, and you're playing the good role. You're doing the happy part. You have the nice part of the astonishment. Other people have others, but lift up your heart and rejoice. And the second is, don't weaken. Gird up your loins, she says. You've got to go through a lot now, but you're up to it. Take advantage, the next he says, take advantage of every support God has provided. Take upon you my whole armor. Says, I will give you, you'll need it, but you'll get it, but you've got to take it on yourself. You've got to protect it. How? If you do everything you can do, he said, then you will survive, that you may be able to withstand the evil day, having done all, that ye may be able to stand. If you do everything, suppose that you will be able to stand. Withstand what? The evil day. So there's going to be a rough time ahead, and you can do it. Well, so with this modest beginning, they're on their way. Now we have the defense here, and this, in the Middle Ages, called the Loria, a famous long Latin poem written in Spain, six figure called the Loria. It's an elaborate mystical allegory of the armor that we wear, the armor of spirit and so forth. They're meant to be learnedly obscure so that nobody can understand them. So the idea of girding yourself with the armor, this is commonly meant with the and also in the scripture. But here it's very interesting because the imagery is frankly imagery. There is a neat mixing of metaphors, one where he talks about the sword here. Get that. He says, the sword of my spirit, which I will pour out upon you. Of course, spirit, which he pours out upon you.
The, well, truth is our calling. Now the, he talks about the armor here, the preparation. Stand, therefore, having your loins girt about you with truth. Now that's your confidence. That gives you your firmness and strength, the girt loins and so forth. And the second is the breastplate of righteousness. Righteousness is our defense. Righteousness is the breastplate. And what is the message? Properly learned, the message is the message of peace. He says here, and your feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace, which I have sent mine angels to commit to you. So you have the preparation of the gospel, you bring a peaceful message, and your confidence, because you have the defense, it's the defense of righteousness, and your confidence is in truth. Where you have this doctrine of confidence, I have sent my angels to commit it to you, he says. The impenetrable shield. We get these science fiction, these space thrillers now, where the spaceship always has to be defended by a shield of force of some force set up around it, so the space pilot can't hit it. You set up a shield around various types of shields. Shields are getting to be very important in our work when we see, when we feel so much on the defensive. You may have noticed this week the call has gone out. All members of the church, including the sisters, have been encouraged to go down the probe here and take instructions on how to defend yourself. But when it's reached that point in a civilization, in Provo, Utah, we haven't far to go, but where we all need shields all the time, we have so little trust among ourselves, is what goes on. But notice, you have to have a shield. And this is a shield that uses a very good description. It reminds you very much of the thing you get from space wars of various kinds. This shield will absorb the fiery darts. The fiery missiles that are shot at you will be absorbed and neutralized by the shield. And that shield is faith, the big thing. You know, it's used a nice science fiction imagery here. Taking the shield of faith by which you shall be able to quench all the fiery darts. See, they send these fiery missiles at you, they simply fizzle, quenches them, it puts them out. It defuses them and breaks them down. And then, of course, we have, this is an important thing I noticed here, you know, it's all defensive. You're not fighting fire with fire. You don't shoot fiery darts at anybody. You don't shoot back with these. You do that, you're in the soup again, you've lost, and as the Nephites learned, and it was just one strength against another strength, and the Nephites didn't have a chance, which is on that basis. The same thing here, notice all defensive here. It's the armor you put on, but what about the sword? That's offensive enough. The sword is an all-purpose weapon here, and it's the spirit and the word, and it's effective in all situations. You have one weapon. All the rest has been defensive, but you have one weapon you can use, and this is, he said, the helmet of salvation. You notice that is the principle of protection and adornment, is the helmet of salvation. But the sword is the sword of the Spirit, and he will pour it out upon you. It will have plenty of strength, don't worry. And my word, which I revealed unto you, and be agreed as touching all things whatsoever you ask me, in all situations it will stand by. I say it's an all-purpose weapon. He asked of me, and be faithful until I come, and you shall be caught up where I am. You shall be also. In the end, you'll be rescued, so don't worry about that. So we have this sword, the all-purpose weapon, the Spirit and the Word, which it tells us is effective in all situations. So the brethren are ready to face up to it. I wonder if even they realize what tremendous things are in the offing here. Well, next we have the 27th verse. So that's a marvelously dramatic and exciting sort of thing. It has all the elements of, our more sophisticated modern dramas today. But it's real. And now we come to the 28th section. And here again, you notice, we're on the division, the dividing line between what is real and what is not imaginary, spiritual, or something else. Because this Hiram page has a seer's stone. and it works. But Joseph tells him not to use it. Don't use your serious temptation. It's not the right one. Remember, he says that every man should have a serious temptation. But we're not, every man and woman should have a serious temptation. In fact, women are better at crystal gazing than men, as far as that goes. I mean, if there's a real fortune teller, I know some village, the woman has that gift. Remember right at the beginning, Emma was told that she was the one that should interpret scripture, understand it, read it, and write. And let's hire him page at the Tearstone, because everyone wants to get into the act anyway, people want that. But here we get the authority by which this knowledge is handed around. This leads up to the Tearstone. But here is the position of Oliver. He is to preach just as Joseph did to preach. He is to preach the same thing. But is he to get it in the same way? Does he have the same authority as Joseph? Now, this has come out before, you know, where it's mentioned repeatedly that what he says to one, he says to all, and as Joseph, so the other. Joseph is merely setting the example and giving us the information. Nevertheless, he is a unique figure in this dispensation. Now, Oliver is given the ear of the church, the power to teach or convey correctly the revelations and commandments which the Lord has given Joseph Smith. Joseph receives the revelations and commandments, but Oliver receives the power to teach